Woody Allen's belief that 80% of success is just showing up. I said to myself, are you serious? 80%? Sure, I can just show up. Here I am, New York. Give me a job. It turns out that the other 20% is kind of the difficult, nebulous part. I wrote a letter to NBC asking how I could submit sketches to be considered for late night. I got a letter back saying that the network could not even open an envelope that contained creative material that had not been submitted by an agent. I thought the phrase, cannot even open the envelope, was a tad dramatic. NBC legal, you drama queens. This initial rejection served as NBC negging me, to borrow a phrase from my very favorite book, The Game. It worked. NBC became the sexy guy at the party I needed to be with. When I finally got with him, years later, sure, he was fourth place, kind of fat, balding, and a little worse for the wear, but I still got him. Home is where the bed is. I was jobless, but so were Brenda and Jocelyn. Together we rented a railroad-style apartment in Windsor Terrace, Brooklyn. The railroad apartment, for those of you who have never seen one, is styled after the sleek comfort of the 1930s industrial railroad car. All the rooms are connected in a line, and you have to walk through one room to get to the next. Everything about it is awful, except if you need a set for a play that takes place during the Great Depression. The only people this intimate setup worked for were three female best friends who had no secrets from one another, were comfortable, enough, being walked in on naked, and had no boyfriends, or no boyfriends who were ever invited over. Enter us. Real estate was our first disappointment in New York. We had set our sights on trendy Williamsburg, which had plenty of chic coffee shops, cool boutiques, and cute straight guys. I knew I wouldn't have been able to afford those coffee shops and boutiques or have the nerve to talk to any of those hipster guys. But I would have liked to be around them and felt like it was plausible I could have had that life. After visiting several basement-level tenements that were out of our price range, we settled for Windsor Terrace. When we moved there, Windsor Terrace was a Park Slope-adjacent mini-neighborhood that could have been the exterior set for much of Welcome Back, Kotter. It was populated mostly by middle-aged lesbian couples who had taken on the noble challenge of gentrifying the neighborhood. Brenda and I shared the center bedroom and the single queen bed it would hold, and Jocelyn fashioned herself a sort of bohemian chic burrow out of the last bedroom, which, while it was the only room with true privacy, was also the size of a handicapped bathroom. She installed a twin loft bed and hung a batik tapestry over the lofted area, where she would read books and magazines for hours. Jocelyn is the kind of person who goes into any room, sizes it up, and immediately tries to loft a bed there. To this day, she lives in an apartment with a loft bed. This was a good arrangement because Jocelyn has hoarding tendencies, and some degree of containment was crucial. Hoarding has pejorative connotations now, but you have to understand that this was before the show Hoarders depicted hoarders as gruesome loners with psychological problems. Joss is a hoarder of the cheerful, social, Christmas lights year-round variety. Jocelyn would save stacks of six-year-old magazines because there might be a recipe in one of them for jambalaya, which she would need someday if we threw a big Mardi Gras-themed dinner. This wasn't crazy because we would occasionally do things like that. People who visited our apartment and saw her curtained lair probably assumed Jocelyn was a gypsy we had inherited as a condition of getting the apartment. And the stairs. Oh, the stairs. The staircase in our third-floor walk-up was the steepest, hardest, metalless staircase I have ever encountered in my life. It was a staircase for killing someone and making it seem like an accident. Our downstairs neighbor was a toothless old man somewhere in his 80s or 90s. He lived with what seemed like two younger male relatives, with younger meaning in their 60s. In the dead of summer or winter, they would wear only those ribbed white tank tops grossly named wife beaters, which is how we knew that they were rent control tenants. If anyone wears year-round wife beaters, it is the same as saying that they are enjoying the benefits of a rent-controlled apartment. They also spoke a language with one another that seemed like a hybridized version of an Eastern European language and the incomprehensible mumble of a Dick Tracy henchman. They would have been frightening, except they were incredibly timid and scared of us for some reason. Like when that monster in the Bugs Bunny cartoon gets scared of a mouse and runs screaming all the way back to the castle. In the summer, feral cats and heat clung to the screens of our living room, meowing mournfully until we threw a glass of water at them. When it got cold, the roaches migrated in and set up homes in every drain. Sometimes, when I got up in the middle of the night to use the bathroom, I would feel a disgusting crackly squelch under my foot, and I know I'd have to rinse off a roach from my heel. That was our apartment. We took the bad with the pretty good. Plus, we could afford it. Prospect Park wasn't too far, and people already assumed we were lesbians, so we fit into the neighborhood right away. It was all good. Until we tried to pursue our dreams. I am terrible at everything. Everything I learned about trying to get hired as a comedy writer came from the film and television section of the Lincoln Center Barnes & Noble. I didn't have the money to buy many of the books there, so I spent hours sitting in the aisle, copying down sections in a loose-leaf notebook. I was not the worst offender. There were aspiring screenwriters sprawled all over the place there. They'd nurse a single cup of coffee for hours. One kid I saw there all the time frequently brought a large pizza with him and ate the entire thing slowly while handwriting inquiry letters to literary agencies. It's interesting to note that this Barnes & Noble no longer exists. Perhaps no one was buying books there and just eating pizza? The only really valuable thing I learned from the Lincoln Center Barnes & Noble was that the only way I could get hired by a TV show was to write a spec, or sample script, of a popular current show. That's when I started working on my first spec, a Will and Grace sample, having seen the show only a handful of times. I went on one audition when I was in New York. I wasn't actively pursuing acting jobs, but this one was tailor-made for me. It was an open casting call for Bombay Dreams, an Andrew Lloyd Webber-produced musical extravaganza that was transferring from London to Broadway. I was encouraged by the relative lack of actresses, aged 18 to 30, who sang, lived in the tri-state area, and also looked Indian. Nothing gives you confidence like being the member of a small, weirdly specific, hard-to-find demographic. The first Bombay Dreams audition was a singing audition. I auditioned with Somewhere Out There from An American Tale. In the audition room, I saw some Indian girls, but mostly Latina girls trying to pass for Indian. The audition sign-in sheet read like it was for a production of West Side Story. My singing audition went really well, mostly because they were relieved an actual Indian person was auditioning. On the way out, the casting assistant walked me all the way to the street, saying, "We were really so happy you made it out here." I nodded demurely like I had a million other auditions that week that were more exciting than this one, and left. They were so happy I made it out there. Why not just hand me my start paperwork? On the subway, I started planning what I would do when I got the job. First, I would go to Dean & DeLuca and buy some tiny marzipan candies in the shape of fruit, an expensive treat I noticed a lot of fancy-looking older white women buying. Next, I would pay for an exterminator to come to our apartment and kill the cockroaches. After that, I'd take Brent and Joss out to dinner at Le Cirque, like I was a creepy Wall Street sugar daddy, and they were my pretty arm candy. I got a call back for a dance audition. I had never danced in my life and did not know what to wear. I went to a dance clothing surplus outlet in Chelsea that I had seen ads for in the Penny Saver. Their stuff was discounted because it was irregular, which means the colors are weird or some buttons were off. When I was there, I bought brown tights, a sleeveless pink leotard, and a white iridescent skirt that wrapped around my waist and was fastened with Velcro. I capped off the entire look with some traditional pink ballet slippers. In the communal mirror of the dressing room of the surplus store, a young Asian girl trying on ballet clothes with her mom said, "Mommy, you should dress like that," referring to me. The mom hushed her in an Asian language. This sealed the deal. I had never felt more graceful in my life. At the audition, I looked like a fucking idiot. The other girls were all dressed in versions of what actual dancers wear, which is low-key black leggings, a tank top, sneakers. I looked like a children's birthday party performer playing Angelina Ballerina. You know, the ballet dancing mouse. A Kevin Federline-looking choreographer taught us an incredibly complicated Bollywood dance routine, which we then had to perform on tape. I stumbled through it like a groggy teamster who had wandered into the wrong room backstage, breathing heavily and vaguely hitting my marks. K-Fed stopped me before the song was done and kindly asked if I needed some water. I laughed because, as everyone knows, laughing is a great way to disguise heavy breathing. I then exited on the pretense of getting a drink and quickly left the building. It remains the single most embarrassing performance of my life, and it's on tape somewhere. I like to think Andrew Lloyd Webber watches it whenever he's feeling down. My Will and Grace spec? Oh, it was a disaster. In an attempt to achieve the cheeky, gay-centric tone of the show, I'd written a sample so over-the-top offensively gay that it actually reads like a propaganda sketch to incite anti-gay sentiment. So, things were coming together nicely for me to embark on a full-fledged depression. One good thing about New York is that most people function daily while in a low-grade depression. It's not like if you're in Los Angeles, where everyone's so actively working on cheerfulness and mental and physical health that if they sense you're down, they shun you. Also, all that sunshine is a cruel joke when you're depressed. In New York, even in your misery, you feel like you belong. But it was still hard to fail so consistently at everything I had once been Camilla Parker Bowles level good at. Brenda and I would fix that, but we didn't know it yet. the exact level of fame I want. I obviously want to be super famous and for everyone to love me. That's why I got into this racket. It helps that I love writing jokes, but let's face it, that was just the means to an end. Oftentimes when I'm in the writer's room at the office, it's 11 p.m. The script we're rewriting is halted because we're all waiting for our boss to approve an outfit for the character Pam that shoots the following day, and my mind wanders. First, I wonder if I will ever get the opportunity to live in a treehouse, like the one in the Swiss Family Robinson house in Disneyland, where we'd have a giant seashell for a sink. After I realize that, no, that will never happen, I think about the exact level of fame I want. To me, the person with the best fame is Conan O'Brien. When I interned at Late Night, I thought, wow, this is the guy who has totally nailed being famous. Nobody cared what he wore, some kind of dark-colored suit. His hair was famously always the same, and he got to sit at the same desk every episode. Clearly, he was a hard-working genius, but he was the only famous person I saw who was always being himself. Everyone else had to be someone else. Conan did strange little comedy bits that were completely his style, interviewed celebrities who were much more dressed up than he was, and even got to do cooking demonstrations. When I interned there, I noticed he never ate the food during commercial breaks. I didn't understand that level of discipline at all. I didn't want to be Regis or Kathy Lee because their chairs were too high. I'm sorry, I'm supposed to sit like that for an hour? Too much blood rushing to my ankles, no thank you. Once I saw Paris Hilton leaving a restaurant in Hollywood and the paparazzi cameras were all over her. It looked so unpleasant. It wasn't because she didn't look sensational. She was that perfect combination of fashionable and slutty. It's because the paparazzi guys were shouting these insanely rude and intrusive questions at her, like asking her who she was sleeping with and stuff. I was kind of interested in the answer, so I was glad they asked, but it was still gross. But then, behind Paris, I saw Sacha Baron Cohen quietly exit the restaurant completely unnoticed, walk up to the valet, get in his car, and drive away. Can you believe that? I mean, it's Sacha Baron fucking Cohen. Wasn't sure where to put the fucking in there, but I think I chose right. None of the paparazzi had any idea who he was, but he was also, like Conan, one of the most respected living comedy icons in the world. And I thought, man, I want to be that famous. Here are some more ways that I'd love to be famous. I am required to declare that these ideas are technically owned by NBC Universal because I imagined them while on their payroll. I never have to wait in line for brunch. Like everyone normal, I would never have a bumper sticker ever. However, if I saw one that read, "Hell is waiting in line for brunch," I might buy 1,000 and plaster my car with them. I'd like to be so famous that if I ever want to lazily eat out on a Sunday afternoon, someone whisks me past a long line of poor slobs waiting in the sun to a private table. I get to see the Lakers all the time. Look, I don't need to have Jack Nicholson seats or whatever. Honestly, who needs to live in constant peril of a sweaty, 7-foot-tall, 240-pound guy falling on you? But I'd love to be so famous that people who do have amazing tickets would be psyched to have me come with them. I just want to sit close enough that I can ask the Laker girls questions about their makeup regimens. Teenagers idolize my look. I was at Benefit Cosmetics picking up some lip glosses and trying to scam some free samples one Saturday a few months ago. While I was there, I saw two adorable ninth grade girls getting makeovers for their semi-formal, which was that night. They both had torn out reference pictures of Emma Watson. When I was their age, I had done the same thing with pictures of Meg Ryan. I was obsessed with her edgy shag from the otherwise forgettable movie Addicted to Love. Not having access to fashion-forward hairstylists, I, of course, made the mistake of bringing the photo to Charlene, the old Portuguese lady who did my mother's hair in roughly the same way for 15 years, the Patricia Heaton bob. Charlene squinted at the photo, told me to put it away, and gave me a Patty Heaton bob. Copying a celebrity's hairstyle is some enviable adoration right there. Since I don't think anyone will ever want my haircut, it'd have to be something else. Maybe kids would want my perfectly hairless forearms. If I support a cause, I can actually help it. Sean Penn, like, lives in Haiti, right? That's too much. I can't do that. That's some hardcore goodness right there. But I'd love to make an enormous impact by being the vocal spokesperson for a cause. Somewhere on the level of Mary Tyler Moore ending horse carriage rides in Central Park. The fashion police slaughter me constantly, and I don't care. There's a certain badassness to someone like Helena Bonham Carter, who just doesn't give a crap about what the fashion police say. And when I say fashion police, of course I'm speaking of the small group of screeching gay guys and fashion experts on that E! Show led by the reanimated corpse of Joan Rivers. Joan actually is still pretty great. When Emmy Awards show a few years ago, she said my dress made me look like I was going to the prom from hell. It traumatized my entire week, but even I had to admit that it was a pretty funny thing to say. The point is, it only traumatized me because I had the time to be traumatized. I want to be so famous and busy that I only ever find these insults amusing and chuckle at them good-naturedly before I get on my private jet to be a UN ambassador to Cameroon or whatever. Batshit stuff I wear is immediately considered fashionable. This is kind of related to what I just said. I want to be able to rock harem pants or black lipstick like Gwen Stefani does and have people be like, that's just Mindy, and then everyone starts doing it. When I get old, I'm a sight gag for TV shows. I want to be so famous that people put me in their TV shows as the desiccated old broad who gets big laughs simply because no one has ever seen such an old bag of bones recite memorized lines, and because the sight of me brings up warm, nostalgic memories of their youth. Future hipsters will love me, ironically. I can never go to jail. It'd be great to be so famous that if I murder someone, I will never, ever, ever serve any jail time, even if it's totally obvious to everyone that I did it. I have to have a pseudonym. I read that Michael Jackson used to have prescriptions for Demerol under the alias Jack London. So much about Michael Jackson's life was tragic and strange, but that detail is just so cool. I like to think that Michael Jackson was like, let's see, who do I want to commemorate in my request for drugs? You know what? I always did love White Fang. Jack London it is. My alias for hotels and stuff would be Gwendolyn Trundlebed, a nonsense name I've always loved that my friend Mike Schur came up with during the third season of The Office. My stand-in gets plastic surgery to look more like me. In movies, actors will sometimes have a stand-in. The stand-in is an actor who is hired to stand in the place of another actor for lighting purposes, so the first actor can take a nap or go do drugs in his trailer. I worked on a movie once where the lead actor, a very famous actor whom I'll call Tony Dash, traveled with his personal stand-in. They were best friends. It is already weird to be best friends with someone who looks like you, but the absolute weirdest part was that the stand-in had gotten extensive facial plastic surgery to look more like Tony. I think he did it so that Tony would never ever think of hiring anyone else to be his stand-in, and that he'd have job security for the rest of his life. He looked like the half-melted version of this famous actor. It was horrifying and titillating at the same time. It just showed so much power. I want there to be some slightly grotesque version of me following me around, on sets all over the world, and we hang out and we vacation together. Kenan Thompson plays me on SNL. I can't tell whether I would hate this or love this so much. There are arguments for both. I'll say love it for now. Karaoke etiquette. With the exception of Japanese businessmen, no one likes karaoke more than I do. When I graduated from college, my Aunt Trila and Uncle Keith gave me the single best present I've ever received, a professional-level karaoke machine. I don't know if they were aiming to become my favorite aunt and uncle for all eternity, but that was their result. When I arrived in Brooklyn with Bren and Jocelyn, we set that machine up to our TV before we had a better couch. We just take turns belting Whitney Houston in an empty room while the others sat Indian style and patiently waiting their turn. Because we were unemployed for so much of those first months, and also because we are cheesy, crooning ham bones, we did a lot of karaoke. Now, in L.A., all the best birthday parties I go to take place in a karaoke bar, or, for the true karaoke experience, a dark, windowless box in Koreatown that smells faintly like Korean-style chicken wings. Let me explain some things I think will really maximize the karaoke experience for you. When I pick songs for karaoke, I have three concerns. 1. What will this song say about me? 2. How will I sound singing it? And 3, how will it make people feel? The key is that the third one matters the most by a factor of 100. When most people sing karaoke, they think of themselves as a contestant on American Idol, and they sing and perform their hearts out. But I really think people should be thinking of themselves more as a temporary DJ for the party. It's kind of a responsibility. It's up to you to sing a kick-ass, upbeat song that sets the mood for your friends to have fun, drink, and pick up girls and guys. And it kind of behooves you to pick a short song. I don't care if Don freaking McLean shows up in a red, white, and blue tuxedo. No one is allowed to sing American Pie. It's actually kind of hostile to a group of partiers to pick a song longer than 3 minutes. Stray observations I would like to add. I like when small people sing big brassy songs, like, say, if my friend Ellie Kemper sings Big Spender in a booming voice. I also like when guys sing girl songs, but not in a campy way. Like a guy earnestly singing Something to Talk About by Bonnie Raitt? That's wonderful. Guys sometimes do this thing where they sing a Britney or Rihanna song and they do a campy impression of the singer to be funny, and it's so painful. An amazing thing to do is to pick a song that has lyrics in another language. That's why I tend to sing La Isla Bonita for karaoke. I would die if a guy sang a Gypsy King song. Die in a good way, obviously. Day jobs. In other places in this audiobook, you've heard the fruitless attempts I made while living in New York to pursue my goal of show business employment. This section is about my attempts to get day jobs. At first, I call this chapter, Mama's Got to Pay the Bills. But I thought that title made it sound like maybe I had been a stripper or had a brood of illegitimate children. It was October 2001, and I lived in New York City. I was 22. I, like many of my female friends, suffered from a strange combination of post-9/11 anxiety and height of Sex and the City anxiety. They are distinct and unnerving anxieties. The questions that ran through my mind went something like this. Should I keep a gas mask in my kitchen? Am I supposed to be able to afford Manola Blahnik shoes? What is Barney's New York? You're trying to tell me a place called Barney's is fancy? Where are the fabulous gay friends I was promised? Gay guys hate me. Is this Anthrax or Powdered Sugar? Help, help! The greatest source of stress was that it had been 3 months since I'd moved to New York and I still didn't have a job. You know those books called From Homeless to Harvard, or From Jail to Yale, or From Skid Row to Skidmore? They're these inspirational memoirs about young people overcoming the bleakest of circumstances and going on to succeed in college. I was worried I would be the subject of a reverse kind of book, a pathetic tale of a girl with a great education who frittered it away watching syndicated Law and Order episodes on a sofa in Brooklyn. From Dartmouth to Destitute, it would be called. I needed a job. Caring for the young and eating their food. By placing hundreds of neon green flyers all over the wealthiest neighborhoods in Brooklyn and Manhattan, I finally got a job babysitting. I was paying my $600 portion of rent taking care of two adorable girls named Dylan and Haley. Dylan and Haley were from a wealthy family in Brooklyn Heights. Not wealthy in a simply went to private school way. Wealthy in a each had her own floor of a historic brownstone in Brooklyn Heights and wore all organic clothing way. I guess crazy loaded is the more accurate way to say it. Their dad had invented the internet, or something like that, not Al Gore. And whenever I walked into their mansion on Pineapple Street, I always whispered to myself, this is the house that inventing the internet built. Dylan and Haley's parents had divorced years before, and I never met internet inventor dad. I only interacted with gorgeous internet inventor marrying mom, who looked like a slightly older Alicia Keys. Internet inventor marrying mom hired me on nights when she went out on dates or had plans for a girls' night with her all-black, all-glamorous friends. Later, I read that internet inventor dad was seriously dating an internationally famous supermodel. They rolled high. If my babysitting stint were taking place now, they would have a dynasty of reality shows on Bravo, and I'd be the pixelated chaperone escorting the girls to Nick's courtside seats. Once, internet inventor marrying mom gave me an unopened bottle of Clinique Happy that someone had given her and she knew she'd never use. It's not fancy or anything, she said sheepishly, as though she were handing me a bottle of Lady Musk by Walmart. What is this world, I thought. Clinique isn't fancy anymore? I was a little worried about babysitting at first because, though I have the voice of an 11-year-old girl, I have no natural rapport with children. I'm not one of those women who melts when a baby enters the room and immediately knows all the right age-specific questions to ask. I always assume the wrong things and offend someone. Does he speak yet? Does what he says make sense, or is it still like a gurgle babble? Also, I'm always worried I'm going to accidentally scratch the kid with my fingernail or something. I'm the one that looks at the infant, smiles nervously, and as my contribution to small talk robotically announces to the parent, your child looks healthy and well cared for. So it was surprising that I killed it as a babysitter. Or maybe killed it is a wrong and potentially troubling way to express what I'm trying to say. The point is, I was an excellent babysitter. It helped that the kids thought I was a genius. It was so easy to seem like a genius to Dylan and Haley when helping them with their homework. For instance, one night I explained that the mockingbird in the book To Kill a Mockingbird was actually a symbol for the character Boo Radley. Dylan looked at me with wonder. "Why are you babysitting us?" she asked. "Why aren't you teaching at a college?" I also knew what little girls want to talk about, which is boy bands. Haley and I would talk for hours about which member of NSYNC we'd want to marry. After long deliberation, the answer was always J.C. Chazé. Joey Fatone's last name was always going to be Fat One, no matter how great he was. And even though they didn't know at their age that Lance Bass was gay outright, they sensed he'd make a better good friend and confidant. As for Justin Timberlake, well, JT was the coolest and the hottest, but too flashy. So we couldn't trust him to be faithful. J.C. Chazé was the smart compromise. We would talk like this in complete unironic seriousness for hours. The reason I was better than other babysitters was that I would never rush them. In me, they had an open-minded listener to every pro and every con of spending the rest of their lives with each band member of NSYNC. I may have gotten more out of it than they did. When the kids went to bed, the real fun began. Me turning on Showtime at the Apollo in their tricked-out den and going to town on all the kid-friendly snack food in the house. Kid-friendly food is the best because kid-friendly simply means total garbage. I ate frozen chicken nuggets shaped like animals, fruit chews shaped like fruit, and fruits shaped like cubes in syrup. I discovered that kids hate for any food to resemble the form it originally was in nature. They are onto something because that processed garbage was insanely delicious. I spent some excellent Saturday nights watching Monique strutting on stage at the Apollo, while I ate a handful of children's chewable vitamins and wrapped myself in my boss's cashmere kimono. I did it so much that it actually became a problem. One evening after her bath, Haley pulled me aside, racked with guilt. "Mommy wanted to know who ate all the turtle-shaped bagel pizzas, and I knew it was you, but I lied and said it was me." She burst into tears. I hugged her and told her, "You can never tell her the truth." And then I let her stay up an extra hour watching Lizzie McGuire. Bribes and boy bands, that is all you need to know to be a good babysitter. Babysitting did not pay the bills or give me health insurance, which I guess is good because otherwise I would probably be an au pair somewhere right now. I needed to get a real job. Network Page Dreams. The Page program at the network TBN is very prestigious. No, TBN is not the real name of the network, but there is an old saying, "Don't bite the hand that feeds you," which applies here. The TBN Page program turns ambitious, overeducated 20-somethings into friendly, uniformed butlers. I wasn't sure it was really my style, but it seemed like the first rung on the ladder to somehow working in TV. Young television writers all aspired to be TBN pages, in the hope that a late-night talk show host like Craig Ferguson or Conan O'Brien will eventually overhear them uttering something witty while leading a tour, and then say, "You're brilliant. Why don't you come work for me and be my best friend?" They hire only 70 or 80 pages a year, out of something like 42 million applicants. I decided that the odds were stacked against me, which, strangely, made me feel like I was going to get the job even more. Sports movies had brainwashed me into the belief that when the chips are down the most, that is when success is the most inevitable. I'm the kind of person who would rather get my hopes up really high and watch them get dashed to pieces than wisely keep my expectations at bay and hope they are exceeded. This quality has made me a needy and theatrical friend, but has given me a spectacularly dramatic emotional life. Anyway, I got called in for an interview with the program. I wore a pinstripe skirt suit I ordered from the clothing section of the Victoria's Secret catalog. You know that section, where they can make a woman modeling a pair of overalls look slutty? Yeah, it's amazing. I thought I looked pretty awesome, like one of Ally McBeal's friends in cheaper material. I arrived 15 minutes early for my interview, which was the first of my three mistakes. I was interviewed by a paunchy and balding man named Leon. He was one of the guys who managed the Page program, and it was obvious that lunchtime was his 30-minute respite from the hell job of interviewing an assembly line of ambitious, obnoxious, liberal arts school grads. He didn't have an assistant to tell me to wait outside. There was no outside to his tiny office, or a waiting area, as I thought there would be. It wasn't a posh enough job to have earned him all these extra rooms. My early arrival meant that either he would have to interview me or I would have to wander around Midtown for a while. Unfortunately, he chose the former. He reluctantly shoved his Quiznos sub aside and told me to have a seat. Strike one. Life had been hard on Leon, his portliness and baldness obscuring his relative youth. Looking at a photo on his desk of him with two little kids, I asked, "Oh, are those your kids? They're so cute." He looked aghast.
"I'm 25. Those are my nephews. You think I have kids?"
I was unable to conceal my surprise. "Oh, it's just that you don't look..." I mean, you seem so much more mature than that. Leon gestured to me.
We're basically the same age.
Without thinking, I immediately responded, well, I'm actually 3 years younger than you. Why on earth did I correct him on this point? Oh, because I was a snotty little idiot. Strike two. Leon asked me while eyeing his Quiznos sandwich longingly, why I wanted to be a TBN page. I answered honestly, saying that I would be honored to work for a terrific company that had been host to all my favorite shows growing up, and that the opportunities that came from the page program seemed amazing.
Hold on.
Leon stopped me.
So you only want this job for the opportunities it affords?
I was puzzled. I mean, that's part of why I'm applying, yes.
This job is more than just a stepping stone.
Leon jotted down a short word on my resume that could only have been the word hate or yuck. Strike three. Leon was now openly disgusted with me. What had he wanted? For me to say that all I wanted to do in my twilight years was give people backstage tours of morning talk shows? Oh, yeah. Yes, that's exactly what he wanted me to say. I left knowing with certainty that I had not gotten the job. It was hard to be devastated because it had been such a top-to-bottom disaster. Now when I watch my friend Jack McBrayer excellently portray Kenneth, the career NBC page on 30 Rock, I understand what kind of commitment Leon wanted from me. I wonder if Leon is a consultant for that show, or still a page. I work for a TV psychic. Still babysitting, no health insurance. I begin to become a germaphobe because I could not afford to get sick and go to the hospital. From a friend of a friend, I landed an interview for an entry-level job as a production assistant on a show I'll call Bridging the Underworld with Mac Teagarden. This was a cable program featuring the psychic Mac Teagarden, who relayed messages to members of the studio audience from their dead friends and relatives. The morning I interviewed for the job, I had an enormous pimple on my face. A giant pimple is bad news for everyone, but if you have dark brown skin and a huge whitehead in the center of your forehead, it is especially disgusting. It wasn't even one of those stoic pimples that goes quietly when you pop it. This one was cystic and painful and had roots that seemed to extend into my brain. I wanted to postpone my interview, but it would have been a last-minute change, and I wanted to hide the fact that I was a vain flake for as long as I could. Coincidentally, Vain Flake is the name of my perfume, available at your finer drugstores and coastal Kmart. So, with my zit throbbing like a nightclub, I went to the interview. My interview was with a segment producer named Gail and the executive producer Sally. Sally was a stout, masculine-looking woman, but not unattractive. She reminded me of a blonde Rosie O'Donnell in her height, appealing, confident, and a tiny bit brusque. They were both very nice and seemed highly concerned about filling a position made vacant by their last PA, who had left abruptly for Teach for America. Thank you, Teach for America, luring away America's finest minds so the rest of us can snatch up their jobs. My interview lasted 8 minutes. I could type, I could get coffee, I didn't have an accent. I guess old throbby on my forehead was my lucky charm. Working for a TV psychic was not what my parents envisioned after investing in my degree. But the job had health benefits, and this pleased my mother. My mother is a doctor and somewhat of a militant on the subject of health benefits, which is why I may seem slightly obsessed with them. The description of a PPO was more exciting than the job itself. I was working in a job that was vaguely in the world of television, making $500 a week. Cue Madonna's holiday. It's margarita time. I always thought mediums were supposed to be old crones with glass eyes of the drag me to hell variety. Mac Teagarden turned out to be a wildly normal guy. He was a 30-ish former phlebotomist and ballroom dance instructor with a Long Island accent. He was attractive in a Mario Lopez kind of way, with slick back hair and a wardrobe of tight long-sleeve t-shirts. He looked like the kind of guy who lifts weights twice a day, is a great husband, and goes to Manhattan nightclubs with his wife 4 months after Justin Timberlake went there. I liked him a lot. My immediate boss was Gail, the one who interviewed me. Gail was 40, single, and loved the world created by Sex and the City more passionately than any other person I knew. I think she would have disappeared into the show if she could have. Let me take a moment here to stress again just how pervasive the Sex and the City culture was in New York in 2002. You could be a NYU freshman, a Metropolitan Transit Authority worker, or an Orthodox Jewish woman living in a yeshiva. You watched Sex and the City. Without knowing me at all, Gail nicknamed me Mins. I respond very well to people being overly familiar with me a little too soon, It shows effort and kindness. I try to do this all the time. It makes me feel like part of a big, familial, Olive Garden-y community. Gail would talk at length on Mondays about Sex and the City and how it perfectly mirrored her life. I could tell she wanted a TV show-worthy Manhattan existence, and I knew I was a disappointment to her when I failed to fill the adorable minority sidekick role. By the way, I in no way mean to impugn the fun job of minority sidekick. Minority sidekicks always get to wear Hawaiian shirts and tivas and stuff. I would gladly be the Indian female version of what Rob Schneider is to Adam Sandler to just about anyone. How is your love life, Minz? She would ask hungrily, hoping to be entertained by raunchy details. I had none. You know, so hard to meet guys. I answered vaguely, hoping my lack of sex life would seem mysterious and not pathetic. You're such a Charlotte, she replied. Gail found lemons and made lemonade. That's the one nice thing about being a dork about men. You can sometimes play it off as restrained and classy. Gail loved to talk about how stressed she was. She would do this thing where we would be walking in the hallway and suddenly she'd stop in her tracks, rub both of her temples with index and middle fingers, and theatrically let out a deep guttural moan. Moog. Moog. Minz. I'm just so stressed out, she'd say. I just want to go home, open a bottle of red wine, draw up a hot bath, light some candles and listen to David Gray. A note about me. I do not think stress is a legitimate topic of conversation, in public anyway. No one ever wants to hear how stressed out anyone else is, because most of the time, everyone is stressed out. Going on and on in detail about how stressed out I am isn't conversation. It'll never lead anywhere. No one is going to say, wow, Mindy, you really have it especially bad. I have heard some stories of stress, but that just takes the cake. This is entirely because my parents are immigrant professionals, and talking about one's stress level was just totally outlandish to them. When I was 3 years old, my mom was in the middle of her medical residency in Boston. She had been a practicing obstetrician and gynecologist in Nigeria, but in the United States, she was required to do her residency all over again. She'd get up at 4 a.m. and prepare breakfast, lunch, and dinner for my brother and me, because she knew she wouldn't be home in time to have dinner with us. Then she'd leave by 5:30 a.m. to start rounds at the hospital. My dad, an architect, had a contract for a building in New Haven, Connecticut, which was 2 hours and 45 minutes away. It would have been easier for him to move to New Haven for the time of the construction of the building, but then who would have taken care of us when my mom was at the hospital at nights? In my parents' vivid imaginations, lack of at least one parent supervision was a gateway to drugs, kidnapping, or at the very minimum, too much television watching. In order to spend time with us and save money for our family, my dad dropped us off at school, commuted the 2 hours and 45 minutes every morning, and then returned in time to pick us up from our after-school program. Then he came home and boiled us hot dogs as an after-school snack, even though he was a vegetarian and had never eaten a hot dog before. In my entire life, I never once heard either of my parents say that they were stressed. That was just not a phrase I grew up being allowed to say. That and the concept of me time. It is remarkable that I worked in the administrative offices of Bridging the Underworld without fully examining whether I believed that what Mac was doing was real. My only interaction with Mac Teagarden involved working for his producers. If you've never seen the show, Mac enters a room with a studio audience and asks questions that are presented as information he has received by communicating with dead relatives or dead friends of people in the audience. After he contacted the dead, he'd relay a message and then the show was over. Then a producer would pull the particular audience member aside, interview him further, and create a segment around him. I was one of the assistants who scurried around the selected audience member, collecting photos and getting him or her to sign a release. When the audience members went back home, some of them would continue to call me. They saw me as the messenger's messenger. I have to admit that it was far more interesting to play psychic conduit than it was to scan photos all day long. I spent hours talking to people uninterrupted about their loved ones who had passed away. I had no new psychic information, but I was someone new to talk to and confide in. I was great at it, and it became the best part of my day. It was strangely a lot like babysitting. People wanted to talk to me about what interested them, and I was good at listening to them and not telling them to stop talking. This would come in handy for me later when I became a producer on The Office. If I had to testify under oath, I would admit no. I don't believe Mac Teagarden is a psychic. I've just been made too aware of people like Carl Sagan and Basic Science and stuff. I am certain, though, that Mac Teagarden provided an enormous amount of comfort to people who had unexpectedly lost loved ones. I don't know if it was psychic, but it was cathartic and therapeutic, and it helped people. Mindy Kaling, sexual harasser. I was living in Brooklyn with Brenda and Jocelyn, but Bridging the Underworld was taped in Queens. If I took the nicer subway, it meant I had to go through Manhattan every morning to get there, and that took a really long time. The subway line that ran the short way was the G line, which stopped exclusively in Brooklyn and Queens. That might be the only time the word exclusive has ever been used to describe the G train. At that time, the G train wasn't so hot. My apologies to the train. I'm sure it's amazing now, with like a community garden and charter school in it, but not then. My coworker Rachel also lived in Brooklyn and took the G train with me. Rachel was a pretty Jewish girl my age who was the heiress to a gourmet pickled Jewish food dynasty in LA. She was an amazing cook who made her own bagels, a supremely cocky thing to do in New York, and other delicious food. When I went over to her house to watch TV, there would be homemade arugula for snacks. Rachel and I jokingly and hilariously called the G train the rape train. One morning at work, we were joking about it in the commissary. We did not see the executive producer, Sally, standing a few feet away. "Did you hear the rape train added new stops?" I said to Rachel. "Yeah, what are they?" she asked. "Lurk, stalk, stab, and dump body," I said, very pleased with myself. Rachel laughed. We high-fived. Suddenly, Sally appeared behind us. She looked really upset. "Do you girls feel unsafe when you come to work in the morning?" Sally asked. I was surprised she'd heard us. When you're that low on the totem pole, you sometimes think you're so unimportant that no one can hear you. My sense of invisibility had made me loose-lipped. We hastily assured her that it was just our unfunny, pejorative nickname for the train, and that, based on empirical evidence we had gathered so far, real rapists didn't traditionally attack two girls at once at 7 in the morning, and that we were the real creeps and we were sorry. Sally looked displeased. "It's not a very funny thing to joke about," she said. "It's extremely inappropriate." She turned and left. We were horrified. Later that morning, Rachel and I both got notes saying Sally wanted to see us in her office. "She's going to fire us for sexual harassment," Rachel worried. I was freaked out. Sexual harassment was a real thing. You can't just joke about rape at work. We had endured a lengthy sexual harassment seminar on how fireable this behavior was. Sarah Silverman could make jokes about rape because the fact of the matter was, she was much funnier and cuter than us. This was the problem of living in a post-Sarah Silverman world. Lots of young women holding the scepter of inappropriateness did not know how to wield it. I began wondering what I would tell my parents about getting fired. It would be embarrassing, especially since I had just bought my mother an expensive pair of Uggs with my new money. They were my "I've made it" Uggs. I didn't know how I would tell them. I figured I could conceivably go 3 weeks without their noticing, living off graduation cash my aunt and uncle had given me. After that, I was toast. When we were called in, we found Sally waiting with Joel, the head of human resources. Joel had a really tough job because, as anyone knows, it's absolutely terrifying when someone from human resources is meeting you for any professional reason. Even if Joel simply wanted to share your table in the break room to enjoy a cup of coffee, you'd cringe a little. Oh God, is Joel going to tell me my dental care is no longer covered? God, I hate Joel. I pretty much could only handle Joel for the 10 minutes he was sitting with me going over my start paperwork. Then I never wanted to see him again. He's a lot like the Toby character from The Office. Our situation looked bad. Now we would not only get fired and escorted immediately out of the building by security, but what we'd done would go in our permanent files, following us from job interview to job interview, ruining our careers. "Girls," Sally said, "I took what you said very seriously this morning." I was already making distancing body language from Rachel in my chair. I didn't want them to think we were attached to the hip. "You could fire Rachel and keep me. I'm a minority." "We want a town car to transport you to and from work. We can't have you be unsafe." I couldn't believe it. Being potentially litigious young women had just landed us free car service to and from work, as though we were investment bankers. My inappropriate, unfunny remarks were getting us special treatment rather than getting us fired. I felt like Ferris Bueller. It actually cost the studio more to transport us by town car than it did to pay us. Everyone was instantly jealous. People began sucking up to us, hoping to wheedle a ride home in our town car. I treated that car like an interborough shuttle for all my friends. This is when I learned that crime pays. From Dartmouth to Dirtbag. best friend rights and responsibilities. For almost 8 years, I lived with my best friends in either a cramped college dorm room or a small Brooklyn apartment. Normally, these are the circumstances that drive one roommate to get engaged to some random guy super fast because she is so annoyed with her living situation. We managed it well, however, because we maintained an informal best friend code of conduct. I've outlined its most vital aspects here. I can borrow all your clothes. Anything in your closet, no matter how fancy, is co-owned by me, your best friend. I can borrow it for as long as I want. If I get something on it or I lose it, I should make all good faith attempts to get it cleaned or buy you a new one, but I don't need to do that, and you still have to love me. If I ruin something of yours and I don't replace it, you're allowed to talk shit about me to our friends for one calendar year. That's it. Then you have to get over it. One stipulation to borrowing your clothes is that you have to have worn the item at least once before I borrow it. I'm not a monster. We sleep in the same bed. If we're on a trip or if our boyfriends are away and there's a bed bigger than a twin, we're partnering up. It is super weird for us not to share a bed. How else will we talk until we fall asleep? I must be 100% honest about how you look, but gentle. Look, your boyfriend is never going to tell you that your skirt is too tight and riding up too high on you. In fact, you shouldn't have even asked him, the poor guy. He wants to have sex with you no matter how pudgy you are. I am the only person, besides your mom, who has the right and responsibility to tell you that. I should never be overly harsh when something doesn't look good on you, because I know you are fragile about this, and so am I. I will employ the gentle, vague expression, "I'm not crazy about that on you," which should mean to you, "Holy shit, take that off, that looks terrible." I owe it to you to give feedback like a cattle prod, painful but quick. I can ditch you within reason. I can ditch you to hang out with a guy, but only if that possibility has been discussed and getting a ride home practicalities have been worked out prior to the event. In return, I need to talk about you a lot with that guy so he knows how much I love you. I will take care of your kid if you die. I can't even talk about this, it's too sad, but yes, I will do that. And you will have one awesome little kid who hears endless stories about how amazing and beautiful and perfect you were. Incidentally, your kid will grow up loving Indian food. I will nurse you back to health. If you are crippled with pain because of a UTI, I need to haul ass to CVS and get you some medicine fast. I should also try to pick up a fashion magazine and the candy you like because distracting you from your pain is part of nursing you back to health too. We will trade off being social activities chair for our outings. On trips together, I promise to man up and be the person who drives the rental car sometimes, or uses my credit card and has people pay me back later. Someone needs to check on Yelp to see where the good brunch place is. Neither of us gets to be the princess all the time. I get that. I will keep your favorite feminine hygiene product at my house. Even though no one uses maxi pads anymore like you do, weirdo, I will keep a box at my house for you when you come over. Same with your contact lens solution. I can't believe you won't get LASIK already. You can afford it. I know you read someone who went blind from it, but that was like 20 years ago. Not getting LASIK at this point is like being that girl in 2006 who didn't have the cell phone. I will try to like your boyfriend 5 times. That is a fair number of times to hang out with your boyfriend and withhold judgment. When I take a shower at your place, I won't drop the towel on the floor. Your home isn't a hotel. I forget that sometimes because you make it so comfortable for me. If you're depressed, I will be there for you. As everyone knows, depressed people are some of the most boring people in the world. I know this because when I was depressed, people fled, except my best friends. I will be there for you during your horrible breakup, or getting fired from your job, or if you're just having a bad couple of months or year. I will hate it, and I will find you really tedious, but I promise I won't abandon you. If our phone conversation gets disconnected, there's no need to call back. I get it. You get it. We take forever getting off the phone anyway. This was a blessing. I will hate and re-like people for you. But you can't get mad if I can't keep track. Robbie, don't we hate him? No, we love him? Okay, sorry. It is okay to take me for granted. I know when you fall in love with someone that you will completely forget about me. That hurts my feelings, but it is okay. Please try to remember to text me if you can, if you know I have something going on in my life, like a work promotion or something. No two people are better than us. We fucking rock. No one can beat us. Matt and Ben and Mindy and Brenda. I was finally paying my bills, but Brenda and I weren't doing anything creative. I became increasingly worried that I had moved to New York City to be a professional au pair. Because no one was hiring us to act or write, Brenda and I decided to create something to perform in ourselves. There was a one-hour window per day when I could write with her. She left for her job as a public school substitute teacher in the early morning and got back home at 3 p.m. I left for my babysitting job at 4 p.m. and returned between midnight and 1 a.m. So between 3 and 4 in the afternoon, we met at the apartment to write. Unfortunately, we didn't make great use of this 1 hour. Often we ended up lying on the sofa watching Judge Judy scream at people for a while. More often than not, our 1 hour work session played out like this. Interior, Windsor Terrace apartment living room, 3:10 p.m. Brenda is at the computer in my bedroom eating Honey Nut Cheerios from the box. I am sitting on the floor near her eating a large piece of raw salmon I bought from the supermarket. It was my homemade salmon sashimi, delicious and a fraction of the price it would have cost at a sushi restaurant, though not at all safe. Bren looks up from her computer screen. Bren, what do we want to do? What do we want to say? Me, I think there should be only two characters so we don't have to pay anyone. Bren nods and types this. Pause. Bren, do you want to go watch the Jamie Kennedy experiment? Me, totally. This went on for months. We could spend the entire hour arguing about the plausibility of Harry Potter and not write a single word. In the early aughts, the actors Matt Damon and Ben Affleck loomed large in our lives. They loomed large in everyone's lives, actually. This was the height of Bennifer. Sorry, I hate to resuscitate that term, which the media has thankfully put to bed, but it's important to remember what a phenomenon it was. It was like Pippa Middleton plus Beyonce's legs times the iPad. Bennifer was so big, it was as though two people had never been in love before. I think it's also easy to forget that Bennifer created the trend of the blended celebrity couple name. Without Bennifer, we wouldn't have Brangelina or Tomcat, or even the less used Jabrobra, which is James Brolin and Barbra Streisand, of course. That is the gift that Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez gave us that has withstood the test of time. Bren and I have always done bits, even before we knew they were called bits. Bits are essentially nonsense time, or to describe it more pejoratively, fucking around. We would take on characters, acting like them for a while on the way to the subway or getting ready to go out. For whatever reason, around this time, our favorite recurring bit was when Bren played Matt Damon and I played Ben Affleck. We played the guys very naturalistically, but they had a slightly jock-like dude posture and slightly lower voices. Again, have I emphasized how well we fit into our lesbian neighborhood? Soon, our Matt and Ben had a rich and completely made-up backstory and dynamic. They had private jokes and shared memories, again, all made up. We did no research on the actual people because we didn't care about their actual pasts. The real Matt Damon and Ben Affleck were simply jumping off points for our Matt and Ben. It was a special kind of fun to be two best friends playing two other best friends. Once we had our characters, albeit nutty ones, we gained focus. If I can give one bit of advice to any drama major, high school theater kid, or inmate who is reading this in a prison library with dreams of being cast in the prison play, it's this. Write your own part. It is the only way I've gotten anywhere. It is much harder work, but sometimes you have to take destiny into your own hands. It forces you to think about what your strengths really are, and once you find them, you can showcase them, and no one can stop you. I wasn't going to be able to showcase what I did best in an off-off-Broadway revival of Our Town. I was going to do it playing Ben Affleck. The premise for Matt and Ben is weird but simple. The script for Good Will Hunting falls from the ceiling of a 21-year-old Ben Affleck's apartment while the two are working on a screen adaptation of Catcher in the Rye. They stop work and wonder about the significance of what has happened. The tone is somewhere between The X-Files and The Odd Couple. Here's one of the first scenes we wrote. Matt has arrived late to meet Ben, who is annoyed at him. Matt is late because he was auditioning for a play. Matt and Ben.
And I went, I had to go to this thing first, and then I came here.
What thing?
Nothing, just this audition thing.
For what?
For nothing. You don't know Shepard, Sam Shepard?
Yeah, of course.
You do?
Yeah, he was in the Pelican Brief. I love that guy. With the wrinkles? Is he in the play?
No, he wrote the play. This play called Buried Child, won a Pulitzer. Anyway, it was nothing. It didn't happen.
What didn't happen? The audition?
Nah, I don't know. We'll see.
What's the part?
Vince.
No, what kind of part? Is it good?
Yeah. They were looking for a blonde.
A dark blonde? Because you're not blonde. We entered the play into the New York International Fringe Festival. Jocelyn and our friend Jason produced it, and we sold out every show. I think it was largely because of our tireless grassroots marketing. By grassroots, I mean, of course, environmentally destructive, pest-like papering of the entire boroughs of Manhattan and Brooklyn. Each of us took stacks of postcards and put them in every diner, indie record store, and fruit shop we could find. This was in the 8-month window in 2002 where fruits were incredibly popular. We didn't want to pay a director to direct the show, so Bren and I directed it ourselves. It was a given that we would also star in it, not just because it was fun, but because, again, we didn't want to pay anyone. Our cheapness was the recurring source of our creative decisions. The set was minimal, and we wore guys' clothes that we borrowed from Brenda's brothers, Jeff and Terry. We had no idea what we were doing, but we had a purpose after 2 years of living in New York and not having one. Matt and Ben was a respite from helplessness. In 2002, the Fringe Festival named us Best Play of all 500 shows. The New Yorker wrote of the show, "Goofy, funny, and improbably believable. Kaling and Withers have created one of the most appealing male bonding stories since Damon and Pythias, or Oscar and Felix." That quote was easy to access because I have it tattooed on my clavicle. This is when our lives started to change. Producers got in touch with us to transfer the show off Broadway. We got a director, we got a budget, and we could finally return our costumes to Brenda's brothers. The show went up at PS 122, a beautiful theater in the East Village that at one point had been a public school. There's a special level of cool for buildings in Manhattan that have at one point been something else. Someone might say to you knowingly, "Oh, did you know that this theater used to be a zipper factory?" Or, "You obviously know that this discotheque used to be a church, right?" Or, "We are eating in a restaurant that at one point was a typhoid containment center." That's what I love about New York. If Rikers Island ever goes under, I know Andre Balazs will have that place turned into a destination hotel for urban metrosexuals within a month, tops. People will sit in their cells/hotel rooms and say, "You know a convicted sex offender used to live in this cell, right?" The solitary confinement unit will be the honeymoon suite. The show was short enough that we could do 2 shows a night. That in itself was challenging because in the play, the 21-year-old Ben tries to impress Matt by chugging an entire 12-ounce bottle of apple juice in one gulp. So I actually gulped 24 ounces of apple juice in one night, though the apple juice was diluted. As I've written about in great detail in this book, I'm no dainty girl, but I'm not a camel either, and doing that twice in one evening was pretty nauseating. Word of mouth from the Fringe helped sales. Nicole Kidman and Steve Martin coincidentally came to the show on the same night, and before long the show was selling out so much that we had to add a third performance a night. This meant 3 bottles of diluted apple juice. By the 3rd curtain call of the night, I had to consciously tell myself not to barf when he took our bows. I have never been so excited to hold back vomit. Bloodshed. On the night that Bruce Weber of the New York Times was reviewing the show, I accidentally punched Brenda in the face and broke her nose. How does one accidentally fracture the face of one's best friend? Well, in my defense, there is a fight sequence in the play. It happens towards the very end. Matt has been so antagonized by Ben's immaturity that he tells him he has no talent. Ben, in the heat of the moment, punches Matt in the face. It was a choreographed punch that we had worked on for weeks. But, I don't know, maybe I was drunk on apple juice because my fist connected with her nose. It made a funny little cracking noise, which I should probably note that Brenda did not immediately recognize as funny. That's because Brenda was too busy bleeding. Her shirt was instantly soaked with blood. Noses, for the record, bleed like crazy. It looked like I had stabbed her in the face. The audience collectively gasped. There was a long beat of confused silence, during which Bren looked at the blood in her hand, and then up at me. Then the house manager turned on the lights and Bren ran off stage. Brenda held paper towels to her bleeding face, and I stood by her dumbly, completely in shock at what I had done. Our director, David Warren, appeared backstage moments later. He walked over to us briskly, with the imperturbable cool of a soldier who dismantles explosives for a living. "You have to finish. The show must go on. Go." There was no pussyfooting or assessing our comfort levels. We just had to do it. I had never heard anyone say the phrase, "the show must go on," in the literal sense. Brenda wrapped a makeshift bandage around her nose and valiantly went back on stage. We finished the last 10 minutes of the play, took a bow to a standing ovation from an impressed, if horrified, crowd, then jumped in a cab and headed to the emergency room of St. Vincent's. Bren's nose was officially broken. Years later, she acquiesced, it took her a weekend to not be mad at me anymore.